From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson. Robin is off today. It's Here and Now. And after a conference call this morning with House Republicans, Speaker Paul Ryan had this news. He will not campaign with Donald Trump or defend him and will spend all his energy making sure that Hillary Clinton doesn't get a blank check with a Democratic Congress. He's also telling his members to do what they have to do to win, even if that means distancing themselves from the party's nominee. Meanwhile, there were concerns over the weekend that Trump's vice presidential candidate would drop off the ticket after that tape of Trump bragging about sexually assaulting women was released. This morning on CNN, Mike Pence said that is not happening, and he praised Trump for not backing off in last night's debate.
Donald Trump last night, through this avalanche of media focus through the weekend, squared his shoulders and refocused this election on the issues that really matter most to the American people, and I'm proud to stand with him.
Well, joining us now to talk about that and much more are Here and Now political analyst Paris Denard, Republican strategist not working for the Trump campaign. Hi, Paris.
Hello, hello, hello.
And Angela Rye is with us, Democratic strategist not working with the Clinton campaign. Hi, Angela.
Hello.
And I don't think there's ever been a moment when we've talked to you where more has happened since the last time we spoke to you. But Paris, I want to start with you and what happened just today with Paul Ryan. Is that an admission that he believes, or that members of Congress, Republican members, believe that Hillary Clinton is going to win this election?
No, I don't think that's an admission at all. I think what Speaker Ryan did was admitted what he's supposed to be doing. No one asked him to defend Donald Trump. That is not what he is supposed to do. What he is supposed to do is be the leader of the Republican conference and make sure that he keeps the House and he can stay as the Speaker of the House. That's his number one priority, getting those members in his caucus elected. So that's a good thing. Now, this is not something that's unprecedented or unheard of. We have in the past seen, and we can go back to the last midterm elections, where Obamacare wasn't so popular, and Democrats distanced themselves from President Obama. And so this, when President Bush ran, Senator McCain distanced himself away from George W. Bush. And so we see this happening for political advantages and political gains. But what I think is the most important thing is Speaker Ryan is still going to vote for Mr. Trump, because he knows at the end of the day, in order to pass the agenda that he needs to do for the American people, the opportunity agenda, he needs to have a Republican in the White House to do that. And Donald Trump is his closest ally and friend.
And as go ahead, Angela.
So a couple things here. First, here's the difference between Speaker Ryan saying he's not going to campaign with their candidate in the honeymoon stage and a party not campaigning with an incumbent after they've had some experience with them as commander in chief. And therein lies the difference. He's not even been sworn in. He's not even won November 8th. He has just barely got himself to a month before the finish line. And he is losing. He's literally bleeding establishment Republicans who just barely got on board. He has trivialized the electoral process, not just for Republicans, but for Democrats, independents, and everyone in between, even more than Gary Johnson in Aleppo. This is a crying shame, and we have to call it what it is. This is actually quite an embarrassment that the Speaker of the House is so worried now that the House leadership, the majority, the House majority is on the line, that he can't even stand to be next to Donald Trump. That's damning.
Although he has not pulled his endorsement, interestingly.
No. I'm saying standing with him at an event.
He doesn't want to campaign with him. Well, Paris, what's the calculation for a Republican member of Congress? Is it a better bet to distance from Donald Trump and maybe even unendorse Donald Trump and try to get swing voters? Or is it a better bet to stick with Donald Trump and hold on to the base voters that support him?
These are political calculations that each candidate must do. If you are in a safe district that is Republican, it bleeds Republican red, and you know that the majority, if not all of your supporters, are going to be supporting Donald Trump, and they turn out in massive numbers to support him, you have no reason to not support Mr. Trump, because it doesn't make any sense for you not to. If you are, however, in a district that is 50-40, 60-30, whatever, and it seems as if you may need to have independents to run in order to win, then yeah, they're going to make a political calculation and say, I might distance myself or not support Mr. Trump. It's all politics. At the end of the day, it's all politics. It's about winning the election. So you will find a lot of Republicans who are not going to denounce Mr. Trump or actively or still going to stick with him, because the politics of their districts say, and their states say, it's advantageous for them to support him.
Let's talk about the debate last night. It was quite something to watch. And Angela, let me go to you first, because we had this incredible moment just 90 minutes before the debate started where Trump held a press conference, although I don't think any questions were actually asked from the media. But there was they were sitting at a table with a number of accusers of Bill Clinton. Let's listen here, because Trump then brought it up in the debate.
If you look at Bill Clinton, far worse, minor words, and his was action. His was what he's done to women. There's never been anybody in the history of politics in this nation that's been so abusive to women. So you can say any way you want to say it, but Bill Clinton was abusive to women. Hillary Clinton attacked those same women.
Angela, what did you make of that strategy? And those women were in the debate audience, which is something Trump had threatened for the first debate, didn't do, but he did it this time.
I think shame on Donald Trump. I think it was absolutely disgusting. Jeremy, I was supposed to be in the spin room. And when I saw the press conference start, I was literally sickened to my stomach, in part because as a woman, I just empathized with Hillary Clinton in that moment. And frankly, Melania Trump, she has been humiliated over the course of the last 4 or 5 days. And to see her husband go out and make this worse, not by owning his own actions of 11 years ago, when you hear the Trump surrogates and talkers speak about this, but to trudge back to 20 plus years ago to talk about Bill Clinton's accusers, I'm sorry, but please tell me where on the ticket Bill Clinton is. This is not about Bill Clinton's past transgressions. This
is
about
the ticket.
No, he's not at the top of the ticket, Paris. Her name is Hillary Rodham Clinton, and she can stand on her own. As Donald Trump said himself at the end of the debate, she's a fighter and she's not giving up. So in spite of him trying to humiliate her in front of the American people by bringing this out, something that was so hurtful and so humiliating to her, something that his wife is going through right now, she rose above all of it, true to form, like she talked about Michelle Obama doing. And I could not have been prouder of her. I would have taken off my shoe and thrown it at his head. Like, that's how bad and volatile that was. I really, really applaud her. She gained a tremendous amount of respect for me from holding her ground last night.
What did
she
you
really
think
did.
About it, Paris?
I think it was appropriate, and I wish that there were a lot of people who had exercised the same passion that Angela has for Secretary Clinton towards those women who were violated and mistreated by Bill Clinton. At the end of the day, they deserve to have their voices heard, and it's no different than what
Was that the time and the place for that to happen?
Well, let me ask you this. Was it the time and the place to bring up Ms. Muchado? Was that the time and the place? Was that the time and the place to do that there? I don't know if it was. And I believe that if you're going to go down that road, which Secretary Clinton opened the door to, she opens herself up to President Clinton's record. She can tout his record on the economy, but she also has to stand firm and talk about what he did to women and how she was complicit and how she attacked those same women.
That's
she
victim
was.
Blaming. She wasn't. That's victim blaming. And I think what's even more interesting is that now it's
who's the victim here? The three women that were abused by President Clinton or just Secretary Clinton?
The alleged
victim?
Victims and Hillary Clinton. And Hillary Clinton was a victim. And
I'm glad shameful
you brought
what Secretary Clinton did.
Melania.
It was shameful what Secretary
Paris,
Clinton
I didn't
did.
Talk over you while you
don't
were talking.
Don't make me be like the moderator on the debate
afraid
last night. Let's let Angela.
No, I'm not afraid. I just don't like false rage.
Okay, well then listen.
Yeah, Angela, go ahead.
I just want to bring this up because I think it's also important. One thing that you haven't seen happen, but this is very clear, is none of the victims, the alleged victims of Donald Trump have been paid off. Well, Donald Trump's campaign PAC, Roger Stone, paid off one of the alleged victims.
That's being reported today,
Arkansas, according to ABC News, the Arkansas woman, Kathy Shulton, who was allegedly sexually assaulted, was paid off by Roger Stone. That's how messy and how in the gutter this political season is.
I just want to get to one more thing, because this is also a big story that happened the other day, this WikiLeaks revelations about Hillary Clinton and what she may have said to Wall Street bankers and talking about politicians having a public and private position on issues. She was asked about that last night, and she started talking about Abraham Lincoln. Let's listen.
As I recall, that was something I said about Abraham Lincoln after having seen the wonderful Steven Spielberg movie called Lincoln. It was a master class watching President Lincoln get the Congress to approve the 13th Amendment. It was principled and it was strategic.
Angela, kind of an odd answer, I have to say.
Listen, this one doesn't pass the laugh test for me either, Jeremy. I applaud her efforts, but this is a stretch. I cannot ride with Hills on this answer. I wish that she would have came up with something else. But no, this was a joke. I think that she just should have acknowledged, you know, sometimes in politics, we say some things that are more palatable to the public, right or wrong or indifferent. And sometimes when we're behind closed doors, I know a lot of politicians who do it. Again, I'm not condoning the behavior, but it's true. They say different things to different interest groups and stakeholders, and this was clearly one of those moments. I wish
Paris, just a few seconds left, but your thoughts on that?
Look, it was a straight answer, a straight question about her being two-faced. And instead of being honest with the American people, she decided to blame Lincoln. Just like the last debate, she decided to blame Bush. By the end of this debate series, she's going to blame every Republican candidate or president instead of standing on her own two feet and accepting the truth. This plays into the fact that people don't trust her. It's not Abraham Lincoln's fault. It's yours.
That's Paris Denard, Republican strategist, not working for the Trump campaign, and Angela Rye, Democratic strategist, not working for the Clinton campaign. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thanks, Jeremy.
There are now just 28 days until the election, which has gone on for almost 2 years now. And all along the way, we've been taking you with us on an election road trip. In fact, we'll be in Arizona, Nevada, and Colorado in the next couple weeks. But one of our favorite stops was Nashville, right before the Tennessee primary. Nashville, of course, home to country music, which can go hand in hand with politics, and has over the years. I met up with Don Cusick, a professor of music industry history at Belmont University in Nashville. We met up on Music Row, which has a lot of history all by itself.
Oh, yeah. This was Owen Bradley's office originally, who built the first studio on music, what became Music Row, the Quonset Hut, which is just down the hall from my office, maybe 50 steps or so. This was also the office of Billy Sherrill. This is where Stand By Your Man was written.
And really? Right in this office?
In this office. The piano was over on the wall right behind me, and right over the wall I'm looking at is where Billy's desk was. A lot of those Tammy Wynette songs were written in here.
Today, the office is filled with books about music. There are guitars on the floor and CDs, all pieces of the puzzle that is country music. Why is it called that anyway?
Well, the official reason is that Billboard named it country after calling it folk and then country and western. But it represents the rural roots of the music, the small town roots to the music. In sociological terms, it's country music is the music of the white working class, just like urban music is the music of the black working class. White working class still has blue collars, but they're buttoned down now, and sometimes they have a tie, and they still work with their hands, but their hands are on the keyboard of a computer instead of hands on the shovel.
Why did Nashville become the center of country music?
There's not one single reason, but the biggest reason is the Grand Ole Opry, which became a national show on the network in the beginning of 1939.
It's Grand Ole Opry time!
Howdy, all your friends and neighbors!
Because it was Clear Channel, 50,000 watt, could reach a significant portion of the country. And from there, you have the Musicians' Union allowing in country performers. You have the studios being built here. You have a lot of factors going along. Acuff Rose Publishing. Owen Bradley always said it's because Ernest Tubb, who was one of the biggest stars of his time, wanted to record here, and his label agreed to that.
How did it become involved with politics, or when did that start?
During the 1960s, country music was the counter to the counterculture. And here you have the liberals with rock music, pop music, and country music answering that with songs like Okie from Muskogee, which was an anthem for the silent majority.
And I'm proud to be an Okie from Muskogee. Place where even squares can have a ball. We still wave old glory down at the courthouse. And white lightning's still the biggest thrill of all.
Stand By Your Man, which was traditional values versus going on the honeymoon before you went through the ceremony.
Stand by your man.
are cold and lonely.
But the real involvement came from George Wallace. When George Wallace ran for president, there were country artists who were called on to perform for him, and they did. And they always thought that Wallace was one of them, or he was one of us. And so that direct political involvement really was through George Wallace more than anyone else.
But was it the message in the music that he wanted, or the sound and what it evoked for people?
He wanted a crowd at his rallies so that people would come and see him and hear him. And the other thing was connecting to that counter, to the counterculture.
More recently, country music has helped us in times of national sorrow with its patriotic sound. Just think of the song that played over and over again from coast to coast after 9/11, Lee Greenwood's God Bless the USA.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free.
There's a phrase that we hear from day one, we live in the greatest country on earth. And that phrase has two different meanings. For conservatives, it means done deal, case closed. For liberals, it means we're the greatest country in the world because that's what we want to be. That's our aspiration. That's what we're striving to be. So protesting is legitimate. Pointing out faults, pointing out problems is all legitimate because we are headed in that direction. We're a journey and not just a destination.
So when Lee Greenwood's song becomes big after 9/11, what does that say to you?
It says we're rallying behind the country. That song, they were playing that when the troops were invading Iraq. And we've always felt that we have been blessed by God, that we are a city on a hill, that we are special, we are unique, and we are the best. Toby Keith had Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue, which was a much more belligerent song, much more subtle one out of 9/11 was Alan Jackson's Where Were You When the World Stopped Turning.
Where were you when the world stopped turning on that September day? Were you in the yard with your wife and children, or working on some stage in L.A.?
But there was a whole host of patriotic songs that came after 9/11 and when we entered the Iraq War.
But a lot of them were in that genre of country. Why is that?
Again, because country tends to be have a conservative audience, and that conservative audience believes patriotism is part of that being part of the greatest country on earth. We're going to defend not only the country, but our belief in being the greatest country on earth.
There has also been controversy when country music has gotten too political for some people.
The big one is the Dixie Chicks.
As usual, I didn't plan anything, but I thought I'd say something brand new and just say, just so you know, we're ashamed the President of the United States is from Texas.
When here we were going into the, or in the Iraq War, and she criticized President Bush. And politicians say worse things about each other all the time. But what they said, well, we had a tsunami of patriotism, a tsunami of support for the war and the president, and especially with the country audience, and they were part of the country music establishment, for them to criticize the president, that was total taboo. If they'd been in the pop world, not a problem.
And in fact, we've had some country artists criticizing this president in their songs.
Well, it's a lot easier for the country artists and the country audience to criticize a Democratic president, especially a black Democratic president, for his policies. I think the policies really go back, I mean, the criticism really goes back to policies, the conservative view of small government, individual rights, rugged individualism than anything else. But yeah, it's been plentiful out there.
Like what? Give me an example.
Well, we've had, of course, Ray Stevens has done a number of songs and several albums criticizing the president.
You can't forget about how we did it yesterday. Obama is changing things and doing it his way. And all that I can say is, it's an Obama nation.
Ray Stevens works just down the street from Don Cusick, so we stopped by his studio.
I don't like any politicians whatsoever. I got a new name for them. They're Republicrats. They're all the same. I think Donald Trump might be our guy. I don't know, though. I don't have a crystal ball.
Would you perform at a rally for him?
Yeah, I might.
And what song would you sing?
I don't know. I'll probably write one for him.
What would you call it?
Make America Great Again.
So far, a song that hasn't been written by a country artist. But what role is country music playing in this campaign? Well, at a rally for John Kasich in Nashville over the weekend, listen to what was playing on the speakers. It's a group called Florida Georgia Line. The words, "That's how we do it round here," make perfect sense, says Don Cusick.
Yeah, it's that connection to I'm one of you, you're one of us. It's, you know, it's that connection. We're all in this together.
Now, it is worth pointing out that the vast majority of country music is not political.
What you find most of the time with younger artists is that they don't want to alienate anybody because of radio airplay. They don't want to upset the apple cart there.
Yeah, I have to say, when I listen to country music on the radio, it's usually not about politics. It's about love. It's about, I'm thinking of God is great, beer is good, and people are crazy. A lot of beer songs.
Yeah, well, beer is good. Most country music is about love songs, either getting it, losing it, or keeping it. And bottom line is entertainment. And people want to be, they want to be surprised by the familiar. You connect with the artist, with the songs. And most people connect over love.
And better yet, love of beer.
And I left a six-pack right there on his grave. And I said, God is great, beer is good, and people are crazy.
We are working today, but it is a federal holiday. Many people have the day off and have maybe taken a trip with the family to the beach or the mountains or the countryside. But after some troubling incidents in New York's Adirondack Mountains over the summer, the tourist industry there is asking itself some hard questions about how welcoming it is to visitors who are Black or Hispanic. Brian Mann of Here and Now contributor North Country Public Radio reports.
This started with Alvin Codner. He's Black. He's 26 years old from Florida. He was working in the Adirondacks this summer as a sports instructor. On his day off, he and his friends went to a little resort town called Lake George. Then he says he was confronted by a bouncer in a bar.
He said, "Yeah, sorry about that. You know, I know how you guys like your fried chicken, orange soda, watermelon, Kool-Aid, and white girls."
Then there was a second incident in Ticonderoga, another tourist town nearby. He and his friends were verbally attacked by a white man while shopping in Walmart.
And then the white guy saying, "I want to see you outside. I want to see all three of y'all. And look at the way you look."
We were able to verify key parts of Codner's story. Here's Walmart spokeswoman Leslie Wright.
"The experience Mr. Codner had with another shopper in our store is something no one should ever go through."
Tourism officials here say Black and Hispanic, Asian, and LGBTQ visitors are a growing part of their clientele, targeted by more and more marketing. But in many small towns, where the population is still mostly white, a lot of hospitality businesses, especially little mom-and-pop hotels and restaurants, just aren't ready for that kind of diversity. Kim Riley is with Roost, one of the region's biggest tourism marketing groups, headquartered in Lake Placid, New York. She's white, but says she had a troubling encounter of her own in a bar this summer.
The proprietor of the business telling N-word jokes from the time we entered till the time we exited the building.
Riley says the problem is serious enough in some small towns in northern New York that she's cautious when deciding where to send the people she brings in for press and marketing junkets.
Sometimes those media are Black, and I put their itineraries together, and there are simply some places we won't add to that itinerary because we're not confident that they'll have a positive experience.
The Adirondacks are one of the most popular international destinations in the Northeast, drawing millions of visitors, many of them from big cities in the U.S. and Canada. But surveys show 90% of those visitors are still white. People of color just aren't coming. In an increasingly diverse country, that's terrible for business. Jim McKenna runs Roost. He's Kim Riley's boss. He says tourists like Alvin Codner have to feel welcome, or all the marketing in the world won't bring in the next generation of tourists.
The beginning of the millennial generation is right there now. You know, 43% of U.S. millennials are not Caucasian white. We have to get the business community to understand that it's not, this is the market. it's not something that you don't have to be aware of and understand, because if you're going to grow your business, you're going to have to understand that we have to be a diverse community.
And while this story focuses on one corner of the tourism industry in upstate New York, hospitality experts here say a lot of rural America, parts that are heavily white at least, struggle with the same question: how to adapt, how to be welcoming when a growing number of your customers don't look like you. For Here and Now, I'm Brian Mann.
Today, Oliver Hart of Harvard University and Bengt Holmstrom of MIT won the 2016 Nobel Prize in Economics for their work on contract theory. The two studied issues often seen in the headlines, including CEO pay, company mergers, and whether schools and prisons ought to be privately owned. For more, we're joined by Robert Gibbons, a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management. And professor, I know you've worked with both of this year's Nobel Prize winners. It must be an exciting day for you and your colleagues at MIT.
Fantastic. Times two.
Well, tell us exactly what this prize is for. What is contract theory?
So Hart and Holmstrom are two of the leaders in a major expansion and focus of economics from, you know, the neoclassical focus on arm's length, anonymous dealings in neoclassical markets to a complementary focus on these close-in, specific, often long-run relationships, whether it's between two people in an organization or two firms like a joint venture or an alliance or a government and a firm in a public-private partnership or two countries and so on. So this is super important in economics. So it guides the follow-on empirical work. I mentioned a couple of applications, but there are more. There is work on privatization. There's work in corporate finance. There's work in developing economies where contract enforcement is not so good. There's work on the institutions that support economic activity in every country and in every economy.
But people may be surprised to hear that there is theory to just contracts back and forth between people or between organizations, that there's so much academic thought going into this kind of relationship.
One lawyer, academic, business practitioner friend of mine said, no contract in the world will compel an unwilling partner to perform. So we do think of contracts as being a very important part of economic activity. There are settings, however, in low-income countries and other settings with lack of enforcement where the reaction that one might have in this country that contracts are pervasive and important is less appropriate, right? So if you're sending roses from Kenya to the EU, it turns out that that's done very importantly through relationships and not so much through court-enforceable contracts. And indeed, if you're doing interactions between, you know, a big biotech firm in New Jersey and a small biotech startup, again, they're sort of pushing the limits of contract enforcement. Intellectual property is a notoriously difficult thing to contract about. And so one of the big first steps in this work is to recognize the difficulties of contract rather than their pervasiveness.
So obviously economics in this country touch everybody. We're all concerned with how the economy is doing. Do you think that this Nobel Prize for this research is at some point going to have an effect on our daily lives in a way that we may not even understand yet?
Absolutely. So what it does is helps economics move from an initial focus almost entirely on markets to an understanding of all the other ways that people create economic value together. I think one of the major messages of this work is how difficult it is to use formal contracts only to create the kinds of collaborations in the economic sphere that potentially make everybody's life better. And so their work set up the question of how can economists help a fixed set of people collaborate better together, whether that's in a very small scale or a very big scale. And the answer isn't always set up a better market. And this work enables economists to think about this both in terms of theoretical models and in terms of empirical testing in a wide array of domains, from international trade to exchange in low-income countries to corporate finance issues in developed economies and beyond.
That's Robert Gibbons, a professor of management and organizational economics at MIT's Sloan School of Management, talking with us about this year's Nobel Prize in Economics. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Over the last week, we've been having conversations about each Nobel Prize, and with some of them, it's not clear yet how the research that led to the prize will be applicable. Sometimes it takes decades to find that out. So we wanted to go back into the Nobel vault and check up on some old prizes. Joining us now to do that is Jeremy Berg, editor-in-chief of Science Magazine. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Jeremy.
Nice to have another Jeremy on the show. And we gave you some homework, which was to come up with a couple of examples of this science that maybe seemed off the wall at the time, but is now applied in a practical way. And your first example takes us to the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1952. Tell us what that was for.
So the prize was for the development of new methods for nuclear magnetic precision. So the discovery earlier was that the nuclei of atoms, like hydrogen atoms, are little magnets. And the question is, how strong were the magnets? And so two groups independently actually figured out very clever ways of making these very precise measurements of the fundamental physical property.
And how did that turn out to be useful to us many, many decades later?
Well, this turned out to be incredibly important. At the time, they were very proud of the fact that it was pure physics. One of the winners, Felix Bloch, is alleged to have said the nicest thing about this, that it's pure physics and will never have any applications. Then it was discovered that different atoms, so that say the hydrogen atoms in water and those in methane and natural gas, were different by this very precise measurement. And that opened up into the most powerful technique in analytical chemistry. So chemists throughout the world use what's now called NMR every single day. And there was actually a Nobel Prize in 1991 recognizing that. And then with those methods, people moved on to larger molecules, biomolecules in biochemistry. And there was another Nobel Prize in chemistry in 2002. And along the way, there was a method that was originally called zeugmatography, which was using NMR for imaging. It's now called MRI.
Uh-huh.
So when you hurt your knee or something else and get an MRI, that's all based on the same physical principles. And absolutely none of this was anticipated at the time.
So this prize from 1952, if we hadn't had the discoveries that led to that, we wouldn't have an MRI.
Correct.
Wow. Okay, your second example is the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1973. Tell us about that one.
So this went to E.O. Fisher and Jeffrey Wilkinson, who were two inorganic chemistry for what are called sandwich compounds. So there was a compound that had been discovered accidentally, the structure of which was sort of mysterious, and they both figured out it was like a little molecular sandwich with two flat molecules on top and then a metal ion, an iron in the middle. And this was a completely novel kind of chemical bonding, which fascinated chemists. And it was, the Nobel Committee was very aware of the nature of this prize. The press release is entitled Chemistry for Chemists. And then the quote, the announcement says, This year, the prize has been awarded for work, practical applications of which are not very obvious.
So what are the practical applications?
Well, the class of molecules they discovered, first off, turned out to be incredibly important in the chemical industry. So academic chemists use them all the time. They're used in the chemical industry for as catalysts for example, making plastics, for polymerization of small molecules to make plastics that are in all kinds of products. And there are new methods being developed all the time. For the original molecule itself, it's now found a new application. When lead was taken out of gasoline, old cars that require leaded gasoline, you can't use leaded gasoline. It turns out there you can add ferrocene, this compound that they worked on, and it has the same role. So you can buy special additives, at least in the UK, to add to your gasoline to make your old car that wants leaded gasoline run better. It's also being used now in potentially for drug discovery, so both for anti-cancer drugs. There are experiments that have been done, and for other sorts of drugs, just the shape of the molecule is such and its reactivity that it could be interesting in that regard.
Hmm. Very interesting. So maybe in 20, 30 years, we're going to find out what this week's and last week's Nobel Prizes really mean to us. Jeremy Berg of Science Magazine, editor-in-chief there, thank you so much for doing that homework for us and enlightening us. Thanks a lot.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
There are a number of topics that didn't come up at last night's debate. Immigration, for one thing. There hasn't been a direct question about immigration at either presidential debate this year. There was also no direct question about climate change last night. And another topic that didn't come up is one that our next guest says will impact every facet of economic and political life, and that is the aging of the American population. By 2050, around 20% of the country will be older than 65, compared with less than 10% back in the 1950s. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, joins us from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
And give us a sense of the magnitude of this, of the numbers here, of the amount of people in this country who are going to be older Americans.
I think you set it up really well when you talked about the lack of conversation about demographic change in the U.S. in last night's debate. I do think the media is very good at covering lightning strikes rather than oxygen, very good at covering surprising singular events, breakings of expectation rather than things that are happening slowly yet inevitably. So aging is precisely one of those things in the second category. In the 1950s, less than 10% of the country was older than 65. It was a young country. In 30 years, about 20% of America, one in five Americans, will probably be older than 65. One in five. This shift is inevitable. It is good in many ways. Ecstatically good. A country with so many senior citizens is a sign that individuals are safer than ever from external harm and internal maladies. This is a victory for mankind. But it also brings with it some rather unprecedented challenges, the sort of which this country has never really quite had to face.
And one of those challenges that you write about is productivity. What is the impact on American productivity of having an aging population?
This is a bit of a puzzle for economists. A small consensus is starting to build that as a workforce ages, it becomes less productive. Older countries are less productive. Why exactly? They're not so sure. But there was this recent study that I wrote about that said that a 10% increase in the fraction of the population over the age of 60, so just a small increase, decreases the growth rate of the economy by about 5.5% per capita. So that's a tough statistic to hold in your mind, but basically it puts some numbers on the idea that, yes, as a country gets older, like the United States is getting older, the economy itself, productivity growth, should slow down on a per-person basis.
Just because people are retired, I assume.
Possibly because it's some people are retiring who used to be productive. Possibly it's because older workers are less productive. Possibly it's because there's some sort of trickle-down effect where having a company that gets older makes the company less productive on a per-hour basis. Again, economists aren't really sure. They've just begun to investigate this fact. But it does seem both striking and true.
Does it have an impact on the kinds of jobs that we have to do in this country? I imagine there are going to be more, you know, people that are getting into medical care and things like that.
Absolutely. Historically, Americans, we made stuff. We were farmers, manufacturers. Toward the second half of the 20th century, we served. We were service workers in retail, for example. The future of the economy, however, will be in care. So that is the history of American work in six words. We made, we served, we care. The fastest growing occupations of the next decade are the following: personal care aides, registered nurses, and home health aides. All three are in healthcare. And it should also be said that these jobs are, even though they will potentially become the symbol of American work in the next 20 years, they are very different from the symbol of American work in the middle of the 20th century. Mid-20th century steel workers were highly paid. They were unionized. They were synonymous with masculinity. The future of the economy, however, if it is indeed personal care aides and home health aides, this is work that is often done by immigrants. They are not unionized. They are poorly paid. And instead of white men making stuff, it does tend to be immigrant labor. that takes lower wages in order to make it work in the U.S.
The other thing about an aging population is it does fit into the political situation in this country. We've seen the polls that have come out that have shown quite stark differences between what people 65 and older think and what people, you know, 25 and under think about the politics in this country. How does it impact our political system to have an aging population with a significant number of people, more than ever before in this country, over 65?
It's a great question. I do not have a fantastic, conclusive answer to it, but I will think about it out loud. On the one hand, you have the idea that as America gets older, and older Americans tend to be more conservative, they tend to vote Republican in higher numbers, that says, all right, the U.S. should become more conservative. At the same time, you have a young generation, this millennial generation, that is aging into an age bracket where it is more likely to have economic power, more likely to vote, and this millennial generation is considerably to the left of the rest of the country. So maybe they help pull the country a little bit to the left. Finally, you have the fact that as the country gets older, as the white boomer generation gets older, retires, most population growth is going to come from immigrants, that tends to be Hispanics and Asians, and from younger people having children. And if they are more liberal as well, you could have this really fascinating schism, a conservative bloc that is older and a seriously liberal bloc that is a bit younger. It'll be fascinating to watch it play out.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.